Welcome to Talk Architecture, an occasional series brought to you by World Architecture Festival, in which we talk about the wide world of architecture, architects, and what they're up to. I'm joined here by Jeremy Melvin, WAF Curator. I'm Paul Finch, Programme Director, and we hope that you will find what follows at least partly informative, if not inspirational. Jeremy, we're going to kick off talking about something we both saw at different times, this year's Venice Biennale. Any comments?
Well, Biennale, I think, first of all, obviously it's a very important event in the architectural calendar, even if it only takes place every 2 years. And I think the curator, Leslie Locke, picked a very challenging theme, which is the laboratory of the future. I think within that, there were all sorts of sub-themes, many of which were actually less successful and less searching than the idea of architecture as a laboratory for the future. And I think there were several things that stood out for me. One was the Dutch Pavilion, which I thought was outstanding, where, first of all, they literally took on the idea of the laboratory of the future. There were several different themes and exhibits within it, but one that sticks strongly in my mind. There were a series of drawings by the graphic artist Carleen Kingma, who some people may remember won the first WAF Drawing Prize we did back in 2018. And what she's done is develop the drawing style that she had already evolved by that stage in her career, and used it to explore the idea of how water flows through a city. But it wasn't water qua water, it was water as a metaphor for money. And I think this is one of the most astute and challenging representations of the relationship between money and the built environment, and almost worth going to Venice just to see that.
Yes, I think the I found some of the more fringy events and pavilions more convincing because they, of course, are more focused on one narrow area than the main exhibition, which I thought was good in part because there were some terrific bits of polemic about what has been done to Africa by the colonialists or more recent exploiters of land or territory. But on the other hand, it was interspersed with things which were delightfully architectural, but perhaps weren't quite as focused on this subject of either Africa or the laboratory. And I was reminded of Pliny the Elder's observation, "Semper aliquid novi Africam ad ferre." Out of Africa always come new things. And in some ways, I would have preferred the main exhibition in the Cordieri to have been entirely focused on Africa and what has come out of it, what's happened inside it, rather than a slightly more abstruse notion of everything being a laboratory.
I think I'd agree. I think that Africa, as we know at WAF, has some very fine architects who are not necessarily getting as much international recognition as they deserve. I mean, it's slightly odious to mention just one firm, but Kofi and Diabete from the Côte d'Ivoire are people who I think have done extremely good architecture that deserves to be ranked alongside the best architects from Asia or Europe or America. And I think that there is a huge amount of creativity in Africa, as you can see from the explosion of interest in African art. And Africa is a very young continent in terms of its population. It's growing very rapidly, and it could well do over the next 40 years what China has done over the last 40 years. There are, of course, very big political differences and barriers to overcome. But I think there was a slight sort of twinge that, oh, we can't talk about Africa without talking about how it's been repressed. And I think if you talk about how it's been repressed, it's a jolly difficult blanket to escape from. You know, and actually, most of Africa is oppressed now, but by Africans rather than by Europeans or Arabs or whoever. And I think this is a very unfortunate notion that obviously the legacy of colonialism runs deep. But you can't, you know, stick with that as the only future is dealing with the legacy of colonialism. You've got to look for something new. And that, I thought, was slightly lacking, because there is something new. There's a lot new, as Pliny spotted whatever it was 2,000 years ago.
We should mention that if there's an architect star of the show whose work features in several areas, it's David Adjaye, the London-based practitioner, recently awarded the Order of Merit, who's been in the news for all the wrong reasons. Now, it's not appropriate for us to go into that now, but my feeling was that, as is always the case on these sorts of occasions, we don't dismiss or suddenly regard as something that you can't speak about the work of that office, which has been very good over a long period of time. So I think it's worth making that point. For me, the highlight architecturally of this year's Biennale, if I was to pick a single exhibit or exhibition, as it were, I think would be Kengo Kuma's show, which is on right next to the Academia Bridge, rather than being in the main space of the Giardini. Now, you saw that. Were you as impressed with that as I was?
I was very impressed. I've long been a big fan of Kengo Kuma, who I think is one of the finest architects working today. And we've invited him to WAF, and he's spoken, taken part. So I think it was a welcome exhibition, and it really is an exhibition about an architect rather than a single exhibit, which most of the Biennale really is by force of circumstance. And I think it's at the Palazzo Franchetti, which is, as Paul said, right next to the Accademia Bridge, so it's very central in Venice. And what it is, he's called it, Kuma has called it onomatopoeia architecture. And he takes a few phrases from Japanese, a language that I certainly don't speak, and I think most of the visitors won't speak. But he explains how the sound of the phrase in Japanese have a counterpart in his architecture. Now, as someone who's always tried to make links between language and buildings, I know how difficult it is, and I know how vehemently I was criticised by a certain sort of slightly challenged architectural tutor by this. I think Kuma does it much, much more successfully than I ever could do. And what he does is he works through the traditions of Japanese architecture, the traditions of using certain types of materials, of using certain forms, certain sorts of relationship with the landscape, and actually shows how the sounds have some resonance with the buildings. And I think that is an extraordinarily fecund theme to open up in terms of thinking about what architecture can do, how it can open up the way people look, the way people hear, and the way people think.
And I suppose the advantage of a single show like that in quite a substantial space is that you don't have to pack everything in. In this case, each of his phrases or sounds is, in the first instance, represented by a little sketch or line, and you then see that line translating into the drawings, and then in each case, the projects that he's chosen to show also have really a delightful model. So anyone going to Venice, whatever else you do, don't miss Kengo Kuma. On the other side of Academia Bridge is another quite extraordinary exhibition of a very different scale and a very different atmosphere. This is an exhibition about Neom. Now, Neom is a region that Saudi Arabia has identified as being suitable and appropriate for expansion over the next 25, 50 years. It's about the size of Belgium, and right through the middle of it, going from really central Saudi Arabia right down to the Red Sea, is a Hyperloop rail line. I think it's about 170 kilometres, which apparently, with the miracle of today's technology, possibly tomorrow's, you'll be able to travel that distance in about 20 minutes. And the idea is that at intervals along this line, you create new sort of sub-cities, about 250,000 people, on either side of the line, 200 metres wide, and extraordinarily 500 metres high. Now, this sounds this sort of, can you believe it? Well, the research that's gone into this, and the sort of list of architects who've been engaged, along with their sort of multinational and multi-generational offices, has to be seen to be believed. What did you make of it?
Well, it brings a new meaning to the idea of the railway suburb, at the very least, because in fact that's really what it is. And the late Peter Hall, the planner and historian of planning, wrote very evocatively about how railway suburbs emerged both in the UK and in certain parts of the United States with the development of railways. And this is a new rail technology, the Hyperloop, and it's a series of settlements connected by that line, made viable by that line. So it is in effect a series of railway suburbs, or you may even prefer to think of it as railway urbs. I had several thoughts about this. One is that that part of the world, Saudi Arabia, is generally now thought to be more or less uninhabitable. But 2,000 years ago, it was part of the area where the Nabataean civilization lived, and they're the people who built Petra, the great rock city now in Jordan. Now, there may have been some climate change along the lines, but it's obviously not completely uninhabitable. But the other thing, more relevant for us, is that we are going to have to find ways of inhabiting desert-like areas because of climate change. And this is, you know, at least a viable proposition to see how that might be done. Whether it will really take off or not, who knows, because there are obviously political issues involved here. But it struck me that most of the architects actually came up with very similar sorts of solutions. Now, that may or may not be a good thing. It may or may not be the force of circumstance. But what it meant was that you're going to have an awful lot of internal, high internal atria-type spaces in the new urbanism with a lot of internal planting.
There's even the suggestion that there'll be attention to the sixth elevation. Now, we think of the roof in conventional buildings as the fifth elevation, but in these gigantic spaces, and I repeat, we've got two parallel kind of walls, city walls, if you like, or walls of city, which are 500 metres tall, you will see buildings which are suspended in space. So, as it were, you will see their underside as well as their top side. The list of architects is rather extraordinary. The overall master planner for this was Tom May and Morphosis, but there are lots of architects who featured at World Architecture Festival over the years. Peter Cook, Ben Van Berkel, actually David Adjaye again, doing sort of landscape urbanism, a host of others. And the amount of research that's gone into materials construction technology is extraordinary. My feeling about this is, firstly, would it work at 150 metres rather than 500 metres? But my second thought was, of all the things that I saw in Venice this year, this was the nearest thing I found to a laboratory of the future. And I suppose the thing about laboratories is that they can result in successful experiments or experiments that prove actually you have to do something different. But laboratory, it most certainly is. I want to turn to something else that we've both seen recently, rather extraordinary retrofit project in Malta.
Yes, well, this is the Farsons Brewery building. Which was the brewing base of Malta's biggest brewery, which may not sound like it has to be very big because the population of Malta is quite small, but I suspect one of the biggest brewers in North Africa, Middle East, where most of their markets are. Now, this building was an extraordinary sort of Art Deco building of about 1950, and very unusually, it was designed by the boss of the company, who happened to have been trained as an architect at Turin Polytechnic, I think. And he worked with another architect to design it. And he obviously intimately understood the process of brewing. He also obviously understood something about architecture and made a building with an enormous 200-metre long Art Deco facade that gave it great presence. And at one end is the brew house, which has a series of wonderful spaces and objects inside it where the beer was actually brewed. Now, this was in use until, I think, partly at least, as recently as 10 or 15 years ago. But the family who controlled Farsons, for Ferrugia family, decided they were going to keep the building because it was so intricately tied up with their history as a company. And they searched for an architect who would, not because the architect had proposed the design, but because the architect could talk the sort of language they wanted to hear, to make them think about their history, how to update it, and how to represent both the past and the present and the future in this new repositioned building. And the architect they found was Ian Ritchie, again, someone who's taken part in WEF on many occasions. He's been a super juror as well as an entrant. And he came up with an idea of producing workspace. And this is in Malta. And Malta is in the Mediterranean between Sicily and Africa. And having been there recently, it is more African in terms of the intensity of its heat, I would say, than Sicily. And this these spaces are not air-conditioned. They have some cooling in the structure, but they're not fully air-conditioned. They're sufficiently narrow to be cross-ventilated. The cross-ventilation moves between courtyards, so it's not impacted by noise from traffic or the pollution you get from traffic. And what you get is a series of really very attractive, clean, decent workplaces in a climate where I suspect the default position for almost all commercial space is air conditioning. And this has been very successful because it's been, part of it has been taken by one of the agencies of the government of Malta. Another part, I believe, has been taken by the Japanese embassy and a series of other occupants. Now, what was a brew house has become a sort of leisure centre with a brand store, with a series of sort of F&B outlets, cafes, restaurants, dining terraces. It's really very attractive and very well done. And, you know, those people who were not going to go to Malta for whatever reason would, I think, find it really quite an intriguing thing to see. So extremely well done retrofit with a first-rate client, first-rate architect, working together to develop a way of repositioning a very striking building.
Had a good local architect cooperating with Ian Ritchie on the project, and an engineer called Doug King, who's based in Bath, who made the good point. There's a wonderful book called Renewal, which is about this project, and we both attended a discussion event around the book launch the day before the formal opening of the building, at which Doug King made the point that he believed that the figure of sometimes it's 40%, sometimes it's 42%, sometimes it's 38%, which is said to be the carbon output of construction. He made the point that actually a big chunk of that is carbon, which is the inevitable consequence of the economic activities going on inside the buildings. So it's only the building in as much as that it's occupied by people who are using energy and doing things that themselves generate carbon. An interesting discussion about that. The other thing which was interesting, what a sophisticated client. When they chose Ian Ritchie, they did not ask for designs. They had an invited competition. They got down to the last two. The losing architects made the big mistake of walking in with a design and a model, and the client immediately thought, well, they're telling us what we're going to get, whatever it is we've got to say. Ian Ritchie came in and wanted to have a conversation and got the job. Well, another retrofit forthcoming retrofit, the biggest of its sort in Europe, will be happening in the not-too-distant future. It's the Pompidou Centre in Paris. We were both there for the opening of the magnificent Norman Foster exhibition, which we'll mention in a moment. But one of the people who spoke at the opening is the director of architecture and design, Frederick Migaroo, who also has a key role at University College London, and he has partly set the brief for the competition about what we're going to do with the Pompidou, probably for the next 25 years.
Well, of course, the Pompidou, when it opened, or when it was designed in the early 1970s, was a completely new proposition about an art centre. And that was, I think, one of its strengths. But within that great strength were a series of inherent weaknesses. Because if you want to overturn 200 years of the building of art centres, you are going to throw a bit of the baby out of the bathwater, quite honestly. And I think, without wanting to do the design down, which I admire greatly, I think that did happen with the Pompidou. And the other thing, of course, is that it had an enormously larger number of visitors than anticipated. And I think about 25 years after it opened, of course, in 1977, so maybe 20 years after it opened, it underwent a big retrofit, and now it's about to undergo another. Now, two retrofits in 50 years for a building that's that heavily visited, I don't think it's so bad a record, frankly. And I think it's a testament to the inherent strength of the design and the flexibility, which, of course, was part of that, these enormous 50-metre-wide floor plates without any columns in them, means you can do more or less anything with it. And I think Norman showed that very well with the design, his design for the exhibition, that it takes use of his old friend and former partner, Richard Rogers' ideas of how you make an art centre.
And I must say, I think of all the exhibitions, monographic exhibitions of architects' work that I've seen over the years, I think this is the most impressive, partly because of the extent and range, partly because of its location right at the top of the Pompidou with its dramatic views over Paris, and partly because it's a very comprehensive review. You might say retrospective. I prefer the word futurespective, because the work of the practice has always been about fulfilling a client brief, but always looking to the next problem that's coming down the line. And the comprehensive nature both of the models and the drawings, but also of Foster's own sketchbooks.
Well, I think the sketchbooks are remarkable, and they fill quite a large room at the beginning of the exhibition. And some of them, I think the earliest sketch was when he was a schoolboy, when he was about 14, so quite a long time ago, right up to very recent sketches. And of course, Norman Foster is an architect who develops his designs through drawing. He communicates through drawings. And when I was there and looking at this range of drawings, many of them in sketchbooks, I was reminded of the exhibition about Richard Rogers, Richard Rogers Inside Out, which I curated at the Royal Academy in London 10 years ago, where we had included a selection of Richard Rogers' notebooks. Now, they were notebooks rather than sketchbooks, and I think this was a very important difference between these two architects who are often mentioned in the same breath. That Foster is an architect who draws, and Rogers is an architect, much rarer, who didn't draw. And that meant he had to communicate in other ways. And he communicated through words. Now, given that he was dyslexic, sometimes words were difficult for him. But he evolved a way of using them that was close to poetry. I mean, there was one point where he was talking about the great factories he designed in the late 1970s, many of them with Peter Weiss, the engineer from Alt. And he talked about the column being the enemy in a factory, because factories need to jump and change. Or there was another page in the sketchbook dating from the late 1970s when he was working on the Coin Street development, which never happened on the south bank of the Thames in London. And in that, he drew a table, or he made a table, with one column headed by Lou Kahn and the other RR. And what it was the qualities he thought Kahn understood streets should have, and then the qualities that he thought streets should have. And it was a very interesting comparison of, you know, great architect of one generation comparing himself or calibrating himself against an architect of a previous generation. And I think that that sort of way of thinking as a historian, that's a really interesting point. And it took Richard some persuasion to put these notebooks in. So, oh, that's just something I did. Well, something you did might be interesting.
Well, I think in the same way, Norman Foster, I think, was a little reluctant to show all his books of drawings. And it was Elena Foster who pretty much insisted that he should do so. Because I think she felt that, in a sense, it would personalise the exhibition. Clearly, I mean, this is more than five decades of product of an immensely powerful and authoritative office. I mean, there's one wall in the exhibition which has a list of 10,000 names of people who've worked on all these Foster projects. I mean, it's a true collaboration. But what I think you find in the drawings is this kind of obsessional desire to draw and explore ideas through line, which sort of underwrites what then follows. You see these drawings before you move into the main spaces, which, as you would expect with Norman Foster, I mean, he spent at least 3 months personally designing this exhibition and playing a very constructive kind of game with the sort of ceiling grids and the form of the space itself. And he's used diagonals as a way of allowing flowing movement rather than an enfilade through a series of rooms.
And I think one of the things about Foster is that you can see the idea in the lines in the early sketches. And he has this extraordinary ability to make the line into a building. Very few architects have that. Now, if you think of a very different way of using visual representation to generate ideas, Will Allsop's paintings. Now, Will Allsop's paintings don't, on the whole, become the building. They are a way of starting to think about what the building might do and what it might be. For Foster, it's very clear there is a more or less unbroken sequence of development from the initial sketches through to the form of the building. And actually, that's a very interesting thing to see. It's one way of making architecture. It's not the only way, but it's a very powerful way, as I think Foster shows. And I think there's one other point I'd like to make about the exhibition, which Paul alluded to, which is his idea of the futurescape, a term he coined and which I think Foster has now taken up. But it seems to me that Foster has always served the interests of his clients, you know, from early days through to recent work for people like Apple. But he's at his strongest where he's thinking just beyond the immediate idea of a brief and of a program and of a particular series of problems to be resolved. And that has led him into some, I think, really extraordinary speculative projects, such as the idea of an airport and a whole logistic apparatus around it to the east of London that would go a long way to solving some of the logistical problems within the United Kingdom. Or one small room towards the end of the exhibition where he has the work he's done on buildings in space, buildings on the moon, buildings on Mars. And it really is quite extraordinary how he can move from, you know, the contingent, the practical, the everyday, to thinking 50 years into the future.
And just two other points to add to that. One is that thinking about here and now, one of the successful exhibits at the Venice Biennale is a prototype that he has designed for refugee housing. Now, this is usually thought of as temporary accommodation, but when he did his research and his foundation did their research, they find that the average time that a refugee spends before they find permanent accommodation in whatever is going to be home can be up to 20 years. So he's designed something which has elements of, it's built to last, in other words, and is a kind of very interesting piece of sort of synthetic Foster design, but quite warm. The other thing is, the thing that struck me about current initiatives, even at a fairly advanced age, I mean, Norman's thinking about the possibilities of kind of clean, fission fuel and batteries, which could power a whole urban block for a year. And that's one of the things towards the end of the exhibition. And then finally, there's one coup de théâtre. Since we're in Paris, we might as well use that phrase, where he has a series of models of some of the practices' most famous tall buildings, and they're set on plinths. Now, usually at the Pompidou, it's blackout space. They like the space to be completely separated from the city beyond. And Norman had a big argument with them and insisted that his towers appear with glazing behind them of the Pompidou itself, and you then look out through the tall buildings over to the townscape and the roofscape of Paris itself. And it's just an extraordinary moment in that exhibition. Well, I suppose since we're in France, I saw it while it was still under construction, but I think you have now seen, and we're back to RSHP, formerly Roger Sturt Harbour, formerly Richard Rogers and Partners, and their rather extraordinary kind of museum come storage centre for the Louvre, which is near the town of Lens.
It's in the adjacent town of Lyon, and of course that's the Louvre in Lens, designed by Sarnoff, which opened about 10 years ago. But the facility in Lyon, designed by RSH, is a very different sort of proposition, because it's not for public access. It's a store and conservation workshop for the entire Louvre. So obviously Louvre has its Parisian palace, the former royal palace in the centre, which we all know, with the pyramid by Ian Pei. And it also has a series of franchise satellites, including perhaps most dramatically the one in Abu Dhabi, and then several in France, like Lyon. And the point about having conservation and storage centre is that, like all great museums, it has far too little space to put on show more than a tiny proportion of its collection. But meanwhile, that collection, much of which is part of sort of national patrimony, has to be stored, protected, curated, and made available, not just for exhibitions within the Louvre family, as it were, but for loan exhibitions outside, and also, of course, for scholars to study. And that, it was very difficult under the storage conditions which were pertained, where basically vaults and cellars under the Parisian palace had been occupied. They were fragmented, they were prone to flooding, and this was the main reason to create a new facility, because the Seine has broken its banks on more than one occasion, and likely to do so more often because of climate change. So having a basement store adjacent to the Seine was not a very good idea for these absolutely irreplaceable artworks.
Sounds like the Tate in London. In the old days, the flooding from the 1930s.
And also in Venice and in Florence, you know, where there was serious damage with the flooding. But so this made a lot of sense to take the store out of the Parisian palace and out of the various outhouses around Paris and put them into a new purpose designed building where everything could be catalogued, identified by barcodes. And it could be housed in more or less ideal conditions. And this is a really quite extraordinary building, which allows all the exhibits in store, and I think there are about 250,000 of them, some enormous and some tiny, the smallest about the size of a small coin, the largest very big paintings, and indeed quite a lot of architectural works, columns, archways, things like that. And they can be stored, they can be accessed. Now, all but the largest can be brought from the store to the study room if they're given enough notice and a particular scholar wants to study them. But also there are a series of workshops where these artifacts can be restored, they can be preserved and kept in very good condition. So it is basically the plumbing that keeps the Louvre going, because without it, the collection would probably deteriorate. It certainly wouldn't be as easily accessible. It would become less known. It would probably become eclipsed by other museums that were better able to manage their storage and their preservation. And I think this is a fantastic achievement, actually. And it follows on from RSHP's earlier project, slightly earlier project, for the British Museum, which also included a massive conservation workshop, in this case underground, because it was on a very restricted site, the British Museum site in Bloomsbury in central London, and it also included a temporary exhibition space. It's all part of the British Museum complex, which of course the Louvre is not part of the complex of the Parisian Palace. And remarkably, incredibly remarkably actually, that was the first cultural project which, you know, either the Richard Rogers Partnership or RSHP were asked to design after the Pompidou. Now, I think everyone recognises that the Pompidou was a phenomenon, a really significant cultural project. Not to get another cultural project for, you know, 35 years after that shows something wrong with the process of commissioning, shall we say.
Well, I think there's another point to this. I mean, Graham Sterk, the S in RSHP, won the British Museum job in competition. And of course, that building and the Louvre storage and conservators project are quite unlike the Pompidou Centre. And of course, I think has led some people erroneously to assume that somehow the sort of architectural sort of ethos of the practice is changing. But of course, I don't think it is at all. I mean, Graham Sterk and Ivan Harbour worked with Richard Rogers for more than 40 years. They've done buildings of every imaginable kind of style and approach and colour and volume. But the underlying thinking, I think, is as rigorous as it ever was. And I think there are some, shall we say, more colourful and more expressive buildings to come. But of course, that's because they have a different brief. Let's move back to London for the last bit of this inaugural Talk Architecture programme, if one can call it that. Jeremy, you've been to the National Portrait Gallery, a remodelling by the architect Jamie Faubert. I think it seems to be a hit with most people. What do you think?
I thought it was great. I mean, one very distinguished PR for cultural sort of phenomena said to me that she thought it was the best repositioning of a museum she's ever seen. And I probably haven't seen as many museums as she has, but I think I would go along with that. That it takes what was a sort of, I think it's unfair to call it a second-rate institution, but it's hard not to. Because so many people over decades have tried to reposition the National Portrait Gallery. And I think at the press viewing, the director, Nicholas Cullinan, made a point which I think explains why it's so difficult, that it's an art gallery where the subject is not primarily art, it's about the stories that tie the subject of the portraits it holds to a wider historical discourse. Now, if you think of, you know, the building that's almost adjacent to the National Portrait Gallery, the National Gallery, that is very much a way of displaying art, and it does it, you know, argue well or badly or whatever, but that's the subject. Whereas the National Portrait Gallery is not that. It's an exhibition. It's a museum of history, the sort of visible evidence of which are portraits, mainly paintings, but also some sculptural busts and things like that, photographs as well, of course. And what it was a building designed by an architect called Ewan Christian, who actually won the RIBA Gold Medal. He was chiefly known for church design. And he got this job towards the end of his life. In fact, he died slightly before it was finished. And it was thought of as being really sort of three parts. The northern part, facing Charing Cross Road, which only had came into existence while it was being built, is a sort of version of an Italian Renaissance palazzo. Then the other part to the south, adjacent to the National Gallery, is, you know, a sort of classical gallery. But in the middle, you've got Byzantine Chapel. And it's quite an extraordinary combination of ideas about architecture. And I think that is one of the things that made it difficult to deal with. But also one of the things I think Foubert, who is a phenomenal reader of architecture, and I don't mean that he reads in the literal sense, I mean he understands the propositions that certain buildings make. And you can see that in the work he did at the Tate Gallery in St. Ives, where he had to work with the Evans and Charlef building, a very strong building, but not necessarily working as a gallery 25 years after it was finished, or Kettle's Yard, which was basically a home, you know, a sort of East Anglian, almost vernacular type building, which this guy, Jim Eade, had put his collection of, you know, early 20th century, mid-20th century British art. And again, I think Foubert could read the space so well and work out how to extend it. And I think that that's the skill that has made the National Portrait Gallery so good, because he understood the different sorts of architecture that was in that gallery. Both these three ideas, these three propositions made by the original architect, Christian, but then the various interventions by people like Dixon Jones, John Miller, various other pretty good architects, basically, and make something of them, and to open up the gallery spaces, to use the gallery spaces, to show, you know, some of the portraits are amazing works of art, and some of them would be there, would not be there, if they were showing different subjects. For example, the portrait of the Bronte family by Bramwell Bronte, the brother, who was a bit of a wastrel. You know, frankly, I wouldn't have it on my wall, but it's of value because it shows the family. So that's an example of where, you know, history overrides artistic quality, shall we say. And I think that allowing things to work like that is really good. And I think the curatorial team and Foubert and then the historic specialist Purcell all work together to produce something quite remarkable.
And I wonder if one day we'll have a sort of subsidiary of the MPG, because of course there are thousands of portraits that don't have room to show, which no doubt tell their own story. One recent award in London, the Worshipful Company of Chartered Architects, the livery company for architects in the city, has an annual award, generally for a building. And this year the definition of building was pretty wide, because it's gone to a huge urban space, which includes a pavilion, cafe, restaurant, but is really a space for people rather than four walls and a roof. It's by DSDHA Architects, and the location is called Exchange Square. For those of you who know London, it sits between the end of the roof of Liverpool Street Railway Station, between that and Exchange House, which has a bowsprit arch. It's a large office building by SOM from the 1980s, and it consists of a sort of almost like an amphitheatre, so beautiful limestone curved seating spaces, a huge increase in tree planting and general greenery, and it's an absolute delight. Finally, it would be remiss of us not to mention Hopkins, who died recently, aged 88, a very significant architect in London for many decades, part of, if you like, the famous five of Foster and Rogers and Hopkins and Farrell and Grimshaw. And I think one of the things about Michael Hopkins is the way that he represented both continuity and change or adaptation over the course of the practice's architectural career.
I think this is right. I mean, Hopkins first came to prominence as an architect as a partner of Norman Foster, and split off sometime in the mid-70s, and almost immediately designed, he and his wife Patty, who was always a partner in the firm, a remarkable house, which had a great deal of Foster about it, shall we say, in Hampstead. But I think Hopkins always had an interest in traditional construction. He had restored, I think by that stage, at least one, and possibly more than one, vernacular East Anglian farmhouse. So he understood traditional construction, and I think this is actually what he offered that none of the other architects, Foster, Rogers, Farrell and Grimshaw, did, which was how to work with an existing building or an existing structure to extend the repertoire of contemporary architecture. And I think the first time he showed this was when he picked up a series of brick arches, the mound stand at Lord's Cricket Ground, which became one of the great achievements of sporting architecture of the last few decades. But then he continued it in Bracken House, where he infilled two brick wings designed by Albert Richardson, the sort of die-hard classicist, which had been the offices and print works for the Financial Times. But the central part was really unsatisfactory, where the printing took place. And what Hopkins did was realize you could infill this with a large new building, you know, suitable for a city institution of the 1980s. And it was called Bracken House, after Brendan Bracken, the swell owner of the Financial Times. But then, of course, again, at Glyndebourne, the great opera house in Sussex, south of London, where he took away the original 1930s opera house, but he was working with an existing sort of loosely Tudor-esque manor house, and actually designed a remarkable opera house, which I think is probably the best place I know to see opera.
I think the most extraordinary experience for me in any Hopkins building is Westminster Underground Station. This was an extraordinarily complex project which consisted of the underground station below ground, and then above, the creation of new office space for MPs. Now, the historical context he was working with or against, on the other side of the road from the offices, you've got the Palace of Westminster, Charles Barry and Pugin, and of course, Big Ben. On the other side of the river, on the river elevation, you've got Ralph Knott's County Hall. To the east, you've got New Scotland Yard, or one might think of it as Old Scotland Yard, by Norman Shaw. And he created a sort of two-part building, because below ground, everything is undecorated. You might almost say that it's an engineering project to which architecture has been applied, and it hasn't been applied by putting in decoration or false ceilings or anything like that. Then above ground, there are the complexities of security, potential bomb explosions, where to a certain extent engineering has had to be applied to the architecture. And the story I like about this is that the RIBA suggested to Michael that if he wanted to win the Stirling Prize, the great prize of British architecture, he ought to separate the two and simply submit the underground station, since the judges were certain to like that. They may be more uncertain about offices, because the judges tend not to like commercial buildings, and they might not like some of the slightly more traditional elements of it, wooden panelling inside. And Michael absolutely refused point blank. He said it's a unified architectural concept. And I think in a way that sort of integrity of thinking, that you couldn't have one without the other, they were all of a piece, was a kind of symbol of an architectural approach. And I think you're quite right about this this love of tradition and working with it, because one of his favourite books was Jim Richards, James Richards, editor of the Architectural Review, one of the mass West media partners in the distant past. And a brilliant photographer, also editor of the AR in his day, Eric Damare. And they did a book together called The Functionist Tradition, which was mainly about 19th century buildings, with all the materials that Michael loved. Actually, it's all the things that go into his beloved dinghies and yachts, you know, wood, metal, fabric, And you can almost see in the Mound Stand at Lourdes a sort of a parallel to the things that he loved when he was sailing on the River Orwell. So RIP Michael Hopkins, I think a great contributor to British architecture. And just as important, somebody who acknowledged and respected history.
I think there's one other point to make about what Cullis House was that designed, early 2000s, even a bit before, it was very pioneering in its day of sustainability. And this was partly because MPs probably thought that they should go for sustainability, and partly because it was meant to last 500 years, which is an extraordinarily long life for a building. The energy saving would amount to a very substantial sum over the time. So much of the interiors, for example, the serpentine form of the ceilings, is about getting thermal mass in. And I think it's remarkable. And I think one should say, yes, it's offices, but it's not commercial offices. There's no way it could ever be built as a speculative commercial building. It was built for, you know, highly, in some ways, sophisticated, highly demanding users, British MPs, who might only serve a few years before being turfed out by the electorate. On the other hand, they might serve 30 or 40 years if they're popular in their constituency. So, you know, it's a very strange body to work for, because in the United Kingdom, Parliament is sovereign. And therefore, Parliament can pass an act that makes anything legal or illegal. And, you know, it cannot be challenged in that sense.
And of course, one of the ironies is that, as Michael himself noted, when he designed the building, British parliamentary democracy was very different to what it is today. There were no devolved parliaments in Scotland or Wales. And in some ways, the way that the building is now used is not how it was originally envisaged. Oddly enough, in the great debate about the other great retrofit project in Europe, the Palace of Westminster, Michael worked out that you could place the second chamber, the House of Lords, that you could fit, not all of it, 850 members, but you could fit enough seats into Portcullis House in the substantial ground floor space and run that as the second chamber if you so chose. Apparently security and other technical matters ruled it out, but in concept, it was a very lovely idea. Well, we hope you've enjoyed our sort of walk through Venice, France, London, and areas further afield. And we hope to be back in the autumn with another edition of Talk Architecture. So from Jeremy Melvin and myself, Paul Finch, goodbye.